This is a daily show, and we hold no punches, and we try to be different. And every day we hear more and more of you are watching this show, and you like it. Thank you. Here we go. Truth bomb number one. A former White House advisor says U.S. hegemony is real, and it's aimed at Russia. Truth bomb number two. The Economist describes what U.S.-Russia relations could have been. Truth bomb number three. Comparing U.S. treatment of Poland and Russia and asking, why? I'm Rick Sanchez. This is Direct Impact. So we find this conversation fascinating enough to share it with you. And joining me to share it with you is these two gentlemen. The gentleman that you see right there is a doctor of, what are you a doctor of?
Political science.
Doctor of political science. Thank you. Wilmer Leon, also political analyst and commentator Garland Nixon. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being here. All right. So I am sure you guys both know of Jeffrey Sachs, right? Jeffrey Sachs, award-winning economist, et cetera, et cetera. Really a smart, smart guy, very experienced, used to be invited all the time as an expert on CNN and NBC and other networks. You would see him there explaining things. He was also an advisor to many U.S. presidents and others in government until recently when they decided they did not like him anymore. And they didn't want you to hear what he has to say. So I want you to listen to his explanation of the relationship between Russia and the United States, how it went south, and why he thinks it could have been different. By the way, it's also an explanation of why he's no longer being invited on any of those shows. Here we go.
After the end of the Soviet Union, we thought, hey, we're pretty good. We're the sole superpower. We're the most powerful country on the planet by far in world history. We can do pretty much what we want. And that really was the view in both political parties. So it's not really a partisan thing. It is what we call a neoconservative thing. It was the idea that, hey, we can whoop who we want when we want, whether it's Saddam Hussein or Muammar Gaddafi. We can stick it to Vladimir Putin. We are the United States of America. And we acted on that. We had, remember, Cheney and Rumsfeld and that crowd? Well, we have them in both parties. We have Victoria Nuland in this administration, who was out there helping to overthrow a pro-Russian president of Ukraine in 2014, and now she's the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. So we have these neocons who say, compromise? Are you kidding? We're the United States. And since we think we're so powerful, well, we're in Afghanistan. That's great. Syria, Iraq, Libya, Ukraine. Oh, so successful. And I say, are you kidding? My whole life, you know, I was born a long time ago in 1954. I grew up in the Vietnam War period. And it wasn't just Vietnam. It was Cambodia, Laos, Vietnam. I went through the Contras and Nicaragua. I went through Afghanistan, the first Iraq War, the second Iraq War, the CIA operation to overthrow Bashar al-Assad, the NATO operation to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi. Now the U.S. role in overthrowing Viktor Yanukovych, the pro-Russian Ukrainian president in 2014, this expansion of NATO being tried right now. I just think, yeah, we're powerful, but is this really good for the United States? Is this really working? And my answer is no, it's not working well. And most of all, when Putin said last year, look, the red line is don't expand NATO. And immediately the White House said, oh, no one tells us what to do, least of all Russia. And I called the White House and I said, you know, you should listen. Do not put Russia, do not put Ukraine into this situation. You will make Ukraine the Afghanistan of Europe. And by that, I mean a perpetual war and leveling these cities in Ukraine, as we're watching right now, and millions of people without heat and electricity. And we say, yeah, we're winning. Come on, we're not winning. This is not the right way to behave.
And he said this a while ago, and there's so much to chew on there. And it's fascinating to think that what he's basically saying is, right after the Soviet Union came apart, we had an immense opportunity to be able to build something with the Russian Federation. And instead, we decided, no, we have to continue to be enemies with them. And I mean, here's a guy who was in on it. Here's a guy who was in these discussions. It's fascinating.
And one of the major things, particularly as the Soviet Union was collapsing, the United States saw itself more as a vulture, and that it could go in and just pick the financial opportunities off the corpse of the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union wound up with a country called Russia and a president called Vladimir Putin, who decided, I'm not going to allow you to come in here, just see us as a market, take advantage of our resources, and steal our money. And when he decided to take that position, that contributed greatly to the shift in the perspective of the United States.
What do you make, Garland, of where he talks about how we did everything possible to create a conflict between Russia and Ukraine?
Well, I think what he's basically is talking about here is that the United States intentionally created this to maintain hegemony. That this was, that all of these stories about supporting a democracy or, you know, helping out a country that's been attacked by a brutal dictator next door, et cetera, that these are all lies. That as the United States, as Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote in his book, The Grand Chessboard, as the RAND Corporation wrote in 2019, when they wrote a document literally named Unbalancing Russia, that this was a planned out action to go
sounds like sabotage.
Yes, to go after a superpower, which means it was doomed to fail.
But Russia at the time, post-Soviet Union, seemed to be saying, even according to some of the things that we're reading right now, help us. We want to be like you. We want to try and be a free market economy. And if you join forces with us, we could even combine our nuclear weapons, for example. Let us join NATO, for example, as we've heard on many occasions. Why would you say, no, we don't want you to be our friend. We really want you to be our enemy, no matter how much you want to be our friend. What a horrible, unchristian thing to do.
Because the unipolar hegemon does not have friends. It has vassals, and it doesn't even really have allies in the truest sense of ally. Hmm. It has vassals, it has victims. And because China was in the same position, China had reached out to the United States a number of times. Let's cooperate on technology. Let's cooperate on 5G technology. Let's do this together. China has a win-win strategy. The United States has a what's mine is mine and what's yours is mine, and I'll take it by any means necessary.
You know what I find interesting about this dude, Jeff Sachs? Since I've been watching him, I used to watch him from time to time on the morning shows. They would have him on Morning Joe, mm-hmm. Morning and Mika, or whatever those people are. I mean, they're big into hegemony. And Mika's dad was...
New Brzezinski.
Mr. Brzezinski, who was Clinton's biggest war hawk. And continue to be a war hawk until the rest of his life. I would interview him from time to time. I remember one time I had him on, and he got really mad at me and walked off. And the guys at CNN were like, what just happened? He goes, he walked off. I guess I said something he didn't like or something. But it's interesting to me, and what I'm getting at here that I'd like to get your reaction to is how a guy who, like Jeff Sachs, who once was allowed on television to maybe offer a perspective that I think Americans need to hear, and that our government sometimes is letting us down in terms of foreign policy. That type of person, not only he doesn't appear anymore, nobody like him appears. They're not allowed on television. What the hell?
Well, during the period that they really felt they were in the unipolar moment, they didn't feel threatened by alternative narratives. They didn't feel threatened when people would poke a hole in their
narrative. Who do you mean by that?
I mean, the ruling elite. Yeah. You know, the people who are running our government, who are running things. They didn't feel threatened that even if he said something they didn't like, well, Russia and China, Iran, none of these countries were strong enough to oppose them, so they didn't feel insecure. Now that the narrative's falling apart, that the American people are in opposition to it, they can, and their narratives are getting more and more brittle, they can't afford someone telling the truth. It's not that, and the thing here is, it's not that Dr. Sacks is so smart, which he is, but he's not saying anything that we don't all know. It's that he's honest in an arena where that is not acceptable anymore.
And that's what's so bothersome, because, you know, I'm an immigrant to this country, but I love this country. I love everything about it, and I think we are still great people. I think our leaders are letting us down, but I think we are a great nation with a great concept, and we are great people. And it's a real bummer to see a situation where I think we're making the world less safe for Israel, for example, and for Jews all over the world with our policies now. I think we're making the world less safe for me, for my sons, for my granddaughter, because of our policy in places like Ukraine and China. And that's the reason we give this different perspective that you don't get on the NBCs of the world, right?
Well, yes. And one of the other elements to why you don't see Jeffrey Sachs anymore is because social media and alternative media programs such as these are presenting a narrative and a reality that before folks weren't able to get access to, or it was much, much more difficult for people. So at one point, Jeffrey Sachs was kind of like the voice in the wilderness. Mm. Now, with social media and programs such as this and programs such as ours, we are validating him. He is validating us. And as we see playing itself out right before us at Columbia, they have lost the war of the narrative.
Yeah, it's
and
funny.
That they cannot tolerate. They can't exist.
You know, it's funny you say that, because I checked that. I still do this back when I was an anchor on CNN. By the way, I had the highest rated show on CNN. Did you know that?
In case you used to watch you on CNN.
I'm going to tell you again, I had the highest. No, just kidding. But here's what's fascinating. When I had my best ratings at CNN, which were the best at CNN, on a good day, I would do 450,000 viewers. 450,000 viewers in a country of 350 million. It's actually not so good. This show is seen by hundreds of millions of people around the world. So, and, you know, you guys are probably picked up by more people than watch CNN or any of these local cable shows on any given day. And forget about it. If you're talking about Joe Rogan, he's reaching 9 million a day. So there is a new place for information. Yet, how do these guys at the CNNs of the world stay in power? Because they still get their money from people who advertise on their networks. Because, not because they need to. Raytheon doesn't need to sell bombs to people who watch CNN, but you see Raytheon commercials on CNN. Why?
Because the payment for the bombs comes from this $95 billion bill that Joe Biden just signed.
So it's a branding.
It's a branding issue, and it's also a way of convincing Americans that sending $60 billion to Ukraine makes sense.
And what they're branding is wars. They're branding the concept of eternal wars.
That's all we have.
Finish up, because we got to go to a break.
Yeah, I think the other important part is this. If I'm paying your network X amount of millions of dollars a month, you're not going to say anything that I really don't like. So it's a way to control the narrative in the network itself.
Bingo. When we come back, we're going to listen to Jeff Sachs say something really interesting. So he says, and you'll hear him say it himself, that he was very much involved after the Soviet breakup with two countries, Poland and the Russian Federation. He says, when you compare it, in one case, we did one thing with Poland, and in the case of Russia, we did just the opposite. Why? We'll talk about that. Stay right there. So we were discussing just a little while ago about how both Poland and Russia were treated after the breakup of the Soviet Union. This is fascinating, because when I heard this next comment that we're going to hear from Jeffrey Sachs, the professor, who is one of the leading economists in the United States, I thought of myself. And I'll tell you why in a little while. I thought of myself when we come back after we hear what he has to say. Here's Professor Jeffrey Sachs again.
I became an advisor to Mikhail Gorbachev's economic team, and then I became an advisor to Boris Yeltsin's economic team. And I knew, really from Keynes, by the way, that when the country that you're trying to help is in really, really deep financial crisis, after all, the whole system had completely collapsed, then that country needs some help to get back on its feet. And that was really my main message in 1990, 1991, 1992. And I helped Poland get back on its feet economically. And everything I recommended, by the way, the White House adopted almost right away. And I said, oh, God, good. You know, they're listening to every word. And then I said the same thing about the Soviet Union with Gorbachev. Zero. Sachs, are you crazy? We're not going to help the Soviet Union. They're our enemy. And then when Soviet Union ended and Yeltsin's economic team asked me to help, I said the same thing about Russia. Again, zero. I thought, that's pretty weird, because what I'm recommending for Russia is exactly what I recommended for Poland, and it worked for Poland, and the White House supported what I recommended for Poland, but in the same conditions, it doesn't do it for Russia. I was a little naive, I have to say, because as an economist, I was making economic recommendations, how to help. But I don't think the mood of Rumsfeld and Cheney and others in 1992 was to help. It was, hey, we are the sole world superpower. We get to change everything right now. And then I waited with Clinton coming in, no real change. And then on and on. And I began to see that and understand better, quite frankly, you know, as you grow up in this, because I've really worked all over the world and quite extensively in well over 100 countries. I've visited most of the world and know most of the world leaders one way or another, or many, many of them. And I came to understand that the U.S. was a little bit unhinged, and that the disasters of the Vietnam War era, which I knew full well because I had marched in the streets against the Vietnam War, and Watergate and other, and the abuses, the Contra wars in Central America, and I also worked in Central America in those years. Those were not simply aberrations. Those were part of the design set. And you become more sophisticated. You see a lot of lying that you know is lying, because as I, you know, have become much more, for 20 years, I've been a senior advisor to the United Nations on many things. I see a lot.
You know, it's interesting. I'm joined by Garland Nixon, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Thanks again, gentlemen, for being. When I hear him, remember I said at the beginning that I thought when I heard him say that, I could relate to it. And here's what I mean by that. As you guys know, I've worked at CNN, I've worked at Fox, I've worked at NBC, I've worked at Univision, I've worked at iHeartMedia on radio. And after working in all of those places and seeing a lot myself from the media side, I totally understand his point of view where he said, it's only gotten worse. And now I understand why we did what we did in Nicaragua, as he says, and why we did what we did in El Salvador. And it all came out of that moment when we had an opportunity to bring the world together after the fall of the Soviet Union. And yeah, we did it in Poland, but when I told them, let's do it in Russia, they said, no, we don't want to help them. We don't want to help them. And that carried over mm-hmm. to the satellite countries and everywhere else. I find it fascinating.
One of the reasons why I think it worked in Poland and didn't work in Russia is because of a gentleman whose name we mentioned, I think a little earlier in the show, Zbigniew Brzezinski. When you read the grand chessboard, he is responsible to a great degree for the Russia-phobic American foreign policy. And as—
Because he was.
Because he was, staunchly, and as have been his acolytes. Madeleine Albright is a acolyte of Brzezinski. Hillary Clinton is an acolyte of Madeleine Albright, who's an acolyte of Brzezinski.
How can you have a policy based on hating a country?
And who and who is credited with discovering Barack Obama? Brzezinski at Columbia when Obama was one of his students at Columbia University.
You think he's right?
Yeah, and see, I'm going to do this, too.
Say that again. Am I right?
I think you I'm going to read after the 95. This is a, this tells you the story. After they passed the $95 billion the other day, Senator John Tester tweeted this. America's foreign adversaries like China, Russia, and Iran want nothing more than to take our place as the world's leading military and economic superpower. And today I voted with Republicans and Democrats to protect Montana and our country and make sure that won't happen. He's telling the truth here. Their true concern all along is not, you know, Poland or Russia. It's Poland's not a threat. Poland will be a meal. They will do what we want. And Russia is a future meal. It's like Africa. It's huge. It's got all of these things. They saw that as an opportunity to take Russia's resources, and that was all.
And who was the congressman that said that Ukraine's borders are our borders?
Jerry Connolly, right here in Virginia.
Jerry Connolly said, Ukraine's borders are our borders.
I thought it was sick that after they passed that measure, they all took out
Ukrainian flags
of Ukraine and Israel. And I didn't see a single congressperson in the United States of America waving the United States flag.
What's terrible about—
What the hell does that tell you?
And one of the other thing is this about that. They call this supporting Ukraine. Half a million, minimum of a half a million Ukrainians have died. The Ukrainian people are suffering in this war. Yeah. Let's face it, things aren't going well for Israel right now. With friends like that, who needs adversaries? Mm. If they are truly looking out for the best interest of Ukraine and Israel, they would negotiate diplomatic settlements to both of those, and then they would try to rebuild them and so they could have a peaceful existence. So clearly, they're not looking out for the interest of these people.
And I understand it, and I'm not sure how much certitude they have in this that they've apparently proposed, but the Russian side has on several occasions said we're willing to sit down.
And
you know,
they've been saying
now
that.
It could be gamesmanship too, to be fair. But
I'm sure there is an element of gamesmanship in that, but the history since 2014 shows us that. President Putin has been saying, look at the Minsk Accords.
Yeah.
And one of the things that Putin kept saying to Biden was, all you got to do is implement the Minsk Accords. We've already negotiated this. All you have to do is implement Minsk. And then we find out from the former German Chancellor...
Helmut Kohl?
Angela Merkel.
Yeah.
She said, that was all a fraud from the very beginning. When President Putin met with Biden in Geneva and said, I'm giving you my security demands in writing. I expect for you to respond to me in writing. He got ignored. So...
Well, they had a deal in Istanbul.
Final words. This will change, you think, at some point? You think we'll see a day when a Jeffrey Sachs is allowed back on TV and when people in mainstream media will be able to hear messages like the ones that we share, which are certainly much more balanced?
I think what we're going to have to see first is a political change, some political realignments. But I think that's coming because the political parties now are so far estranged from their own constituents that there's going to be some very serious change. Yes.
Both parties.
Absolutely.
And all throughout Europe.
Thank you. Good stuff.
My pleasure.
Great conversation. This really has been an important conversation. And I'm glad we had, of all people, Jeffrey Sachs to help us with it, a guy who used to watch every day on one of the most liberal programs in the United States, which I back then found interesting. I haven't watched it in quite a while. Before we go, I want to remind you of something. It's our mission. Simple. We kind of want to de-silo the world, stop living in these little boxes where we think everybody has to think like us. Truth don't live in boxes, and neither should we. I'm Rick Sanchez. That's what I say. Anyway, this is Direct Impact, and I'll be looking for you again. Thanks again, gentlemen.